The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So as for the talk this morning, the topic of mindfulness is prominent because of this talk I'm going to give on Wednesday. And since the talk on Wednesday is about the secular applications of mindfulness, I'm planning to keep the Buddhism part kind of out of it. But I thought that I don't have to do that this morning. And it might be nice this morning to kind of give the Buddhist perspective of what mindfulness is. There's been a lot of research and thinking about the difference between and similarities between all the secular applications of mindfulness and what mindfulness means in the Buddhist context. And what's been pointed out is that a lot of the secular applications of mindfulness in the last 20 years certainly has come out of Buddhism, been inspired by Buddhism, but it's been inspired by a very particular and somewhat narrow definition of what mindfulness is. And some of the teachers that were influential, Buddhist teachers influential on this creation of the mindfulness movement, they came out of a particular Buddhist tradition of mindfulness meditation, and so they had a particular take. There are other Buddhist lineages, traditions, approaches to mindfulness besides the particular one that influenced the secular movement. And in fact, if you go back and study the early teachings of the Buddha, he would probably not recognize it as mindfulness the way that it's popularly taught in here in the modern world. Maybe he wouldn't be opposed to it, he would be appreciated, but it seems very, very different from the way he would contextualize it and describe it. So if you look at the early Buddhist kind of approach to mindfulness, you find that it's very hard to find a particular definition of what mindfulness is. There's one well-known definition, that the only definition kind of in the suttas, is that mindfulness, the word sati, translated as mindfulness, means being able to remember things from the past. And so the word mindfulness is closely connected to the idea of memory, and the early English translations of the term sati were, they didn't use mindfulness, they used things like memory, remembering, presence of mind. And then about 100 years ago or so, give or take a decade or so, is when the English-speaking word started to translate sati as mindfulness, and that kind of took value. Though nowadays there are Buddhist scholars who are thinking that maybe mindfulness wasn't quite the right translation of sati, and maybe it should be, one scholar is recommending retention, which I don't know if that's going to work very well. Come to the retention center. But so there isn't a particular definition in the early sutras for what we're doing, what Buddha was teaching, partly because the Buddha idea of mindfulness is wider than a particular function or activity of the mind. It has to do with a whole wide approach to living or a wide approach to practicing. And the comparison I like to make is that between running and training, running to train for a marathon. If you tell someone, I'm running, it begs the question, you don't know what you're talking about. You could be, running from the police. You could be running after the bus. You could be running in circles. It could be many things you're doing when you're just running. Running with your kid, playing around, goofing around. Running doesn't say much. But you can kind of define what running is. It's moving your legs quickly so you can get over, you can define it somehow, narrowly. But it doesn't tell you much. But if you tell someone, I'm training for a marathon, I run to train, that immediately suggests a lot of other things besides the actual physical activity of running. It suggests that perhaps that you're doing it in a methodical way, you're perhaps pacing yourself, you're perhaps pushing yourself in a certain way, you're disciplining yourself, you're conditioning yourself, you're doing a lot of different things that support what that training might be. So in the same thing in Buddhism, when the Buddha talked about mindfulness more often, it was more in that way, that it was a context of a wider training approach. And so because of that, it brought with it different elements, different things. And it's very rare that the practice of mindfulness is taught in isolation from other practices, or mindfulness is taught in isolation from other mental factors, other qualities of mind that get activated and are involved. Whereas in the narrowest approach of mindfulness that exists in some of the Buddhist traditions that I trained in, and then from that kind of secular movement, there's often a desire to define mindfulness very narrowly. And the narrowest definition is something like paying attention to the present moment on purpose without any judgment. Sometimes there's a little bit kind of wider definitions, but this idea of paying attention to the present moment in a deliberate way without any judgment of your experience is the common kind of definition. And so you find that Vipassana teachers, who, like myself, insight meditation teachers, sometimes will use the word acceptance, that mindfulness and acceptance sometimes are very closely connected, this non-judgmental, non-reactive approach, that mindfulness has to do with being present in a very accepting way. And we have a beautiful book by Tara Brach, an insight teacher, called Radical Acceptance, that kind of points this idea. But if you go back and study what the Buddha said about mindfulness, you'd be hard pressed, to really see that he's emphasizing mindfulness as a form of acceptance or radical acceptance. It seems that most of the times when Buddha talks about mindfulness, it's very clearly in the service of something, in the service of some kind of change, not in the service of just accepting things as they are. And so that's a very interesting difference that can be somehow explored more. So if we see it, the mindfulness in the context of the Buddhist teachings as being a combination of practices or a combination of mental factors that come together, then you can ask a very important question. For what purpose? And without the sense of what the purpose is, then you don't, what's the purpose of training in anything? You have to kind of have some sense of the purpose in order to know how best to do the training. And the primary purpose in the Buddhist context, there's two, I would say. One is to live wisely, and the other is to become free. And to become free of the ways in which the way to which our minds or our hearts are in bondage. Freedom and bondage are kind of, opposites. And so the mind is in bondage when it's caught up in compulsion, when there's addictive qualities in the mind, not just addiction with ordinary, what we think of in the West as addiction, alcohol and drugs and things, but when we're addicted to desire and greed, when we're caught up in our hate and hostility, when we don't have any sense of freedom, independence in relationship to what the activities of the mind are. And it's quite humbling to start doing mindfulness practice, meditation practice, and realize how little autonomy or freedom we have in the mind, because the mind seems to have a mind of its own. We sit down with a purpose of maybe focusing on the breath, and it's humbling, embarrassing, shocking to discover how little we can do that because the mind wanders off. Mind goes off into its thoughts. And so the idea is to free the mind from the way it compulsively or addictively or gets caught up in all its reactive concerns, the way that our attention, our awareness, is in a sense hijacked by our emotional reactions, by our habits of mind, by our agendas, so that if you look carefully, you see you're not really free. You're being motivated and driven by forces sometimes that you'd rather not be driven by. You say things you'd rather not say, you do things you'd rather not do, you're feeling things that you'd rather not kind of perpetuate, but it seems like, you're on a roller coaster or the momentum's so strong that you're just kind of like the victim of what goes on. And that sense of being a victim of what goes on without any sense of autonomy or any sense of agency in it sometimes leads to people to want to practice radical acceptance, certain kind of acceptance, where I guess I can't do anything, so I'll just relax and go along with the ride. Which has wisdom to it sometimes, but not if, you know, if what you're accepting is going along with beating your spouse. You know, you feel this tremendous compulsion just, you know, to rob the banks, or tremendous compulsion to, drink alcohol every waking hour of the day. Well, I'm just practicing mindful acceptance of how things are, and you know, this is what's happening. So, in Buddhist context, where that acceptance is not in the service of just going along with his behavior, but mindfulness is in the service of freeing us from compulsive behavior, becoming free. And mindfulness, I think of mindfulness as the kind of the fulcrum between being in bondage and being free. And this is where the definition of mindfulness being deliberate or purposeful, that mindfulness is an activity of using attention intentionally, where we're taking, in a sense, we're taking charge of what we do with our attention, as opposed to having our attention hijacked by other things. So if you're sitting quietly watching, paying attention, maybe to your breath or to the present moment, and then you notice that for the last 5 minutes, you've actually been lost in thought. At that point, your thinking mind has taken over and covered over, hijacked your attention. It's lost. Your attention is lost. Sometimes you're more or less present, but your attention is what you're mostly paying attention to and feeding because of your attention is your fears or your desires or your angers, your resentments, your insecurities. All these kind of, your mind's caught up in these kind of concerns, planning for the future. And so when your mind is strongly motivated to be involved in those kinds of things, it pulls attention along, and we might be paying it, where the attention mostly goes is into thinking these things better or more fully. And we're not in charge then. And many people, I think, in meditation will find that there are themes that keep grabbing them, and their attention goes into, they're not necessarily lost, but their attention keeps focusing on thinking more and more about the plans they have for the next day or something. But when the attention is deliberate or purposeful, when we're taking charge of attention, then we're not letting it be run astray. We're not letting it be taken over by other things. And this is a huge difference between us taking charge and saying, I'm paying attention to this. I'm paying attention to the present moment. I'm the one who's paying attention here. As opposed to subconscious, unconscious, emotional forces within us saying, this is what you're doing with attention, your attention. This is what you're focusing on. This is what you're going to get involved in. You see that difference? So as soon as you say, I'm the one who's going to pay attention, that's where freedom can begin. And one of the things you'll often discover is how unfree you are. But that's much better than being unfree and not know it. So it's time to celebrate. Wow, look how completely unfree I am. Isn't this amazing to know this? Hallelujah. Because if you don't see it, then you're really stuck, right? But if you do see it, no matter how difficult it is, you're beginning to move towards freedom. That's a possibility then. And then once you start seeing it, then you can start asking yourself interesting questions. I'm so amazingly caught up, so much in bondage, but now I know I am. What can I do about it? What would be wise and useful? How can I begin living differently so that I'm not so much in bondage, so caught by this? And then you can slowly, slowly begin making headway in that regard, and slowly begin finding how mindfulness, how attention become freer and freer. So I think of mindfulness as the fulcrum or the doorway where freedom is possible. Now, is mindfulness, so it's very powerful just to come back to this deliberate, purposeful mindfulness. But you find the teachings of the Buddha that he had a wide range of teachings about how to do the training of mindfulness. It's not, he didn't just have one way. He didn't have one definition of what mindfulness is. And I believe because in different contexts, in different situations, different approaches to how to be mindful are useful. Different things are brought together with mindfulness, different elements. So remember, mindful training involves different practices and mental qualities. So in different situations, different things are needed. So one of my favorite analogies in the suttas, I'll give you the second half of it because that's my favorite, and then tell you why I've been a little bit off teaching it only the second half. It's hard to be a teacher. So the analogy is that of a cow herder whose cows are out and about. And, you know, a cowherd is supposed to watch and keep track of the cows. And maybe in ancient India there weren't any fences, so the cows are just out wandering around. And in the fields where they were growing rice, after the rice was harvested and was just stubble, it doesn't really matter where the cows go grazing because they can just, they're not going to cause any damage if the rice has already been harvested. So at that point, the cow herder just leans up against the tree in the shade, relaxed, at ease, and just watches, keeping an eye on the cows, and just watches them roam around, wander around. And nothing's more needed except a relaxed, easy kind of gazing out across the land and just notice where they are. So I like this idea of mindfulness. And mindfulness is about propping yourself up against an easy oak tree in the shade and just watching your thoughts and your feelings and your activities of the mind wander around, grazing about. And you're relaxed. You're not caught by it. You're not involved in it. You're at ease, free. And just let it kind of, let the thoughts just float by and just track what's going on, but otherwise nothing's required. So I like that image. Now, the first half of that analogy has to do when the rice has not yet been harvested and the cows are about. And the farmers have put a lot of effort into growing the rice and they need their crop in order to have food for the year. And so you can't, the cowherder can't just go around and let the cows eat freely wherever they want to be. The cowherder has to ride their cows closely with a stick, kind of leading them, you know, very closely, kind of tapping them on their neck, you know, not there, don't graze there, don't graze there, this direction, that direction, don't stomp on those plants. And they have to be much more involved and engaged in following their cows. They can't just hang out at the tree and just kind of be relaxed. So in that analogy, from that point of view, when the mind is easily caught up in its addictive qualities, when it's easily, the mind or yourself starts doing unskillful, unhealthy behavior, you snap at your friend and you feel you're kind of in a grumpy mood, you're irritated, and you know, if anything your friend's going to say, you're going to snap. So at that point, maybe the wise thing to do is to ride your cows closely and watch your mind closely, and as you're about to say something that you'd later regret, you say, not now, better not. You say, not now. Or certain kinds of thoughts, powerful forms of thinking, even in our own mind, are not helpful to have. They can drag us down. People can get caught up in powerful... They say that one of the primary causes for relapse for people who are in depression is the way they talk to themselves, the kind of thoughts they have. And if you don't watch your mind carefully when you meditate, and you let your mind kind of wander around and think whatever it wants to think, meditation could be a disaster for someone with tendencies for depression. Because the self-talk, I'm so bad, I'm unworthy, I can't manage, you know, just kind of can drag us down. And so sometimes you have to watch the mind very, very closely with your little stick as a cow herder. Say, not, don't go there, not that. Don't go there, please don't do that. You know, because if you just give it free rein, you step back and let the mind do what it wants, it could drag you down. So different contexts. So in one context, when you're already in bondage and caught up and it's not helpful what you're thinking about, sometimes it's very important to get involved in letting go and stopping it and not getting involved. And mindfulness practice in the Buddhist context, Buddhist teachings clearly sometimes is meant be actively involved like that. Don't just be mindful and allow things to be and be mindful just, you know, non-reactively. React or respond, do something. Other times in the teachings of the Buddha, it's very clear he's emphasizing more, don't do anything. Be equanimous, open, be relaxed. Let things just be as they are. Part of the wisdom factor in Buddhism is to be, that's part, one of the things we bring into the training of mindfulness is wisdom, understanding, is to know when one is useful and when one is not. When is it useful to let go, say, no, I'm not going to go there, to use what's called the sword of wisdom, to cut. And when is it useful to just let things be and watch them carefully? When is it useful? Which approach? Some of that's discovered through trial and error. Some of it has to do with how much the capacity we have is for non-reactive, open, clear awareness, mindfulness. Some people have the capacity to step back from whatever's going on. Their mindfulness is strong. And because they're so mindful, they're not involved and caught up at all. And so rather than, it's kind of like by being mindful, you've made a choice not to be involved. This purposeful use of attention, to pay careful attention to what's happening, is a choice not to be involved in the unhelpful thinking that we're having. One person might say, don't be involved in that unhelpful thinking, let go of it. Someone else might say, very strongly and clearly, be mindful of your unhealthy thinking. The consequence of both approaches might be very much the same. Because as soon as you have, both of them involve stepping back, stepping away from what we're thinking or wanting or something. Make sense? So, are there times, so what are one of the kind of implications sometimes in some teachings, modern teachings of Buddhist mindfulness, is you're always supposed to be relaxed, at ease. You see, in some of the discourses of the Buddha, it doesn't seem that that's what he was teaching. Or it doesn't seem, at least. There's one famous discourse where he likens mindfulness, the way you should practice mindfulness, as if you are walking through a crowded marketplace. All these people are jostling themselves, and, carrying a bowl of oil that's full to the brim on your head. You know, that people will balance things on their head, you know. With a person walking behind you with a sharp sword. And as soon as the first drop of oil spills out of your bowl, he's going to chop off your head. Now that's pretty gruesome. You know, so much for these, you know, passive, peaceful, loving, equanimous Buddhist types. Off with their head, you know. But it points to a certain kind of diligence and continuity. You can't let up. Strong, dedicated practice that's continuous. As if your head's on fire, is a famous Buddhist expression. But as you also know, perhaps, or can imagine, if you're tense as you're walking around that marketplace with your bowl on your head, if you're tense, you're more likely to spill the oil. You have to be very relaxed, but you have to also be very attentive. Just the right balance of being sharply attentive and relaxed. So sometimes it's useful to be relaxed and focus on that, and sometimes it's useful to tighten up the effort and be very diligent and continuous. And so you find sometimes the Buddha emphasized one, sometimes another. Here in the modern West, I've seen that enough Western practitioners have a variety of neuroses. Neurosis is here defined as ways of thinking that are counterproductive. So one of the ways of thinking is that there's often a sense of I'm inadequate, I can't do this. There's already something wrong with me. There's a lot of people in the West who already feel that they're bad or wrong before they've even done anything. Which, you know, is kind of a heavy burden to bear. And so, if you tell them, practice diligently, they're going to get all wrapped up and tighten up, and they're going to try too hard. And when you try too hard, then mindfulness doesn't really work so well. And so they feel bad about themselves, and feeling really bad about yourself and getting caught up in those thoughts doesn't help with mindfulness and freedom either. And they'll tie themselves in knots. I remember my teacher I had in Burma. There was one Western practitioner I knew who had a lot of these kind of Western psychological complexes or difficulties that maybe could be summarized in the idea that she was always trying to please her father, and she could never do enough for her father. She had to try harder. So the Burmese teacher had no idea about this, and so he would tell her regularly, try harder. And then to make things worse, he said to her one day, don't come back to see me until you can show me progress. So she would try harder, and she would just tie herself in knots. And the message that she needed to get was, relax, it's okay. You know, I think this is the time for you to practice radical acceptance. Just be present with how things are. And that was the key to get her to kind of relax and soften, open up, and not kind of stir up her mind or agitate her mind or tense her mind by all the striving and doing and proving yourself. So for her, the skillful means was kind of a teaching of acceptance. There are people for whom the teaching of acceptance leads to complacency. Everything is fine, everything's okay, I'll just let the mind wander off. And I've seen some people who have listened to me in a certain way, interpreted what I teach in a certain way, you know, just be present and mindful for how things are, to interpret that to mean I'm going to let my mind think whatever it wants to think, and I'm just going to sit back and watch my mind think freely and track it. And the problem with that is that if you let your mind just think whatever it wants to think, you're not free. Chances are, as you're involved, not only you're involved, probably you're attached. And so to just say, just accept things as they are, supports a certain kind of attachment, certain kind of bondage. And so sometimes you have to say, no, let go. Step back. That's what's needed. So the guideline for how to find our way is not a particular definition of mindfulness, but the guideline is what helps us to become free. And then what are the combination of practices, approaches that are useful in the given situation we find ourselves that day, or the given mind that we have this year? What's helpful for us to become free? And so the Buddha had a variety of different approaches that he associated with mindfulness. Sometimes it was step back, be at ease, just watch everything go by. Sometimes it was more like lean forward into the experience and probe it. And he used the analogy like a surgeon. If a surgeon, apparently in the old days, would have to, you know, use their hands, there was no x-rays and stuff, and they would feel around the body and probe with their hands, maybe inside the wound or inside the cut or something, to feel what was going on in there really well. And they had to be really attentive and feel and reach into and investigate. And sometimes mindfulness has a quality of, you know, you go into an experience, and, you know, it's very active to feel and sense and experience more fully. And sometimes you step back. So in the early Buddhist tradition, mindfulness is very closely associated with being able to discern the difference between what activities of the mind are skillful, useful, helpful to be involved in, and what activities of the mind are not helpful to perpetuate. And having the ability to make that discernment is a very important part of how the Buddha taught, so much so that in one discourse he likened mindfulness to being the guard at a fortified city, the gate guard. And in fortified ancient cities, the function of the guard at the gate is to decide who's allowed into the city and who's not. And so mindfulness has a function of deciding what gets into, what activities the mind lets in and what it doesn't let in, deep in. So if you find lust arising in the mind, maybe that's not a useful thing if you want to become free. So you don't let that in. You kind of leave that alone. You let go of it. If you find generosity arising or loving kindness arising, maybe that's useful given the condition. So you let that in. Let me cultivate that. Let me let that be there. Other times the Buddha gave the analogy of mindfulness as being like up on a high tower looking down at the city below you. You have this great overview. You're not involved and caught up in anything. You're not making any choices and decisions, but you're free and independent. You're not entangled in the city life below you. Sometimes out of a probe, the surgeon going in and looking carefully. So there's many ways. So it's not just one idea, one definition of mindfulness in the teaching of the Buddha. It's a variety of approaches of how to use attention in a deliberate way, purposeful way, so that we learn to become free. So attention, awareness becomes free rather than being hijacked by our emotional reactions, by our agendas, our desires, our fears, and those things. And it helps if you have some ability to know what is it helpful things to be involved in with your mind and what is not helpful, what is skillful and not skillful. And to learn that, we learn that partly by paying attention, by learning what the consequences are, learning what goes on in our mind. Because as we do the self-monitoring that mindfulness is, we start seeing the consequences of how we behave. We start seeing how bad it feels to be caught, to be attached, to be in bondage. We get to see clearly what it's like to be attached and how painful it is. And we start seeing how good it feels to be free. How good it is to feel the mind is more open and free and luminous. So finally, what I'll say is that I think a really important part of mindfulness training is the idea of sense of intention or purposefulness or deliberateness. This, we set ourselves to do this. As the practice deepens or fills out or gets more complete, or as we get stabilized in the present moment, and when mind is not, doesn't have tendencies anymore to be pulled left and right, at some point the sense of deliberateness can be dropped away. And it no longer becomes deliberate. And in some of the more advanced stages of mindfulness practice, it's no longer deliberate, but rather becomes almost like a natural functioning of the mind to be present. They say sometimes a relaxed mind is attentive, or a relaxed, trained mind is attentive. No deliberation is needed. And it's quite beautiful and inspiring to feel the mind open, clear, without intention, without deliberation, relaxed, present but free, present how things are. And sometimes people and teachers get so excited and so enthusiastic by this kind of mind that they point to it too quickly. And they say, this is what's possible, this is what you should do. You should just be free. You should just have not have any intention, no deliberation, there's no will involved. You just kind of just be. And it's inspiring, but sometimes not very useful for people who are, or for us, any given us, at times when our mind is really caught. And then perhaps a different kind of approach is needed. And the part of what it means to be free is to learn how to be fluid and flexible to know what kind of approach is needed at any given time and not to be attached to one particular view or idea of what mindfulness is. And that fluidity of techniques and approaches is a beautiful thing to do. So I've been doing this mindfulness thing for a very long time, it feels to me, almost 40 years now, and I love it. And the more I do it, the more love, appreciation, joy, delight I have in that we have this wonderful capacity to pay attention and set the mind free. So those are my thoughts this morning. I hope they were adequate for you. If you have any questions you'd like to ask for clarification, or we have a few minutes here. Yes, Chris?
I was just thinking that you didn't happen to mention in the course of this talk mindfulness of the body. And it just seemed like one can get so easily caught in struggling with not thinking certain thoughts and so forth, with, and mindfulness of the body is just ally and brings you into being doing it for your own sake and not for, you know, pleasing your father or whatever. And so all that is...
So the mindfulness of the body being an ally, supporting us to really be present here and not getting caught up in the mind and...
I mean, there's just such a long inquiry in how to skillfully... You know, if you recognize obsessive thinking of certain kinds, how to not get caught up in
yes.
it, you know.
Beautiful.
And
yeah.
the body is so important
yeah.
in that.
Yeah, so the body is really important. I mean, so much of, well, there are, again, different approaches, different lineages, teachings, ways that mindfulness is taught. And there are some ways that focus almost primarily on the mind. And some that focus almost primarily on the body. And some that are more integrated, including them all. And you find the same thing in the teachings of the Buddha. Sometimes you focus more on the mind, sometimes on the body. But you find tremendous, in the teachings of the Buddha, tremendous emphasis on the importance of being connected to your body. And there's a very important discourse of the Buddha called the Discourse on Mindfulness Focused on the Body. That's a beautiful discourse because it clearly integrates the practices of mindfulness and concentration. And the way is not so obvious in the other important mindfulness discourse, the discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And so different techniques, different approaches, but what I've found, as Chris is pointing out, is that the using awareness of the body, attention to the body, has been phenomenally helpful and supportive for this whole process. And perhaps she's point, why she raised the question or the issue is that the talk today gave too much prominence to the mind. Anything more? Enough?
So something I experience is that when I choose to pay attention, when I realize I have a choice, and I say, okay, I'm going to put energy into this, I'm going to have skillful effort, there's a point in which I feel a change of sensation in my body where that determination starts to be tensed. And the body starts to be tight. and the thoughts start to be a little bit more harsh. The attitude starts, I'm going to do this. I'm going to...
Yes.
So the question is that attention and that awareness of having choice, that moment of... I think that is clinging into an outcome. Is that... That turns that attention into an agenda?
Right. This is a good, very good question. I think that it's very, very common that when people begin choosing to be mindful and as an activity, something you're going to do, it's a magnet for many of our attitudes to how we think we should do things, how we tend to get involved with things and our self-identity and issues, all kinds of issues. And so an important part of mindfulness of practice is to track and be aware of how we're doing the practice itself. So the example would be, if you're told to be mindful of your breath, that's what you're doing. A person can try to focus so much on the breath, looking at the breath, being with the breath, that they don't notice that they're straining. But it's very important to also notice how you're practicing, to see, oh, I'm practicing with strain. So sometimes you want to look at more subjectively, how is it like for me to practice? Because that's the real key. And it turns out that a lot of where your work is not in the focusing on the breath and becoming constant in breath, but in purifying, clarifying the whole way in which you bring yourself forward in any activity at all. There's so much self and so much desire and ambition or so much self-identity or self-ideas that get in the way that also just come along naturally because in how you practice, because it comes along with everything you try to do in life. But because you're doing mindfulness attention, hopefully it becomes self-correcting. You start seeing this more and more clearly. And you describe very beautifully the effect of how you, when you try to be deliberate, the effect it has on your body, on your mind, is great. So we learn from that, and you say, well, that's not useful. So now let me see, can I find out how to relax? And then, in a relaxed way, be deliberate.
Thank you.
So we should stop, so we can... So thank you. Very much. And so some of you might want to come Wednesday evening to hear the secular version of this.